And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Can you feel it? The winds of change? In some ways, it seems everything suddenly is up in the air. As the president watches his train leaving the platform without him, the great war on terror becomes ever more terrifying. Good old Mother Nature slams a hurricane right into the heart of the oil distribution center, and that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker. Well, what did happen to all those reports that he'd been rediscovered? The answer, my friends, is blowing in the winds of change, and we're going along for the ride when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Many would say that the world is a manifestation of the struggle between opposites, the positive and negative charges of the atom upon which all things depend, seems to keep popping up in various dualities of life, such as male and female, that essentially defines life itself. Life and death, good and evil, freedom and tyranny, war and peace. And somehow it seems that many of these struggles are acting out with greater passion with every passing day. As pro-globalizationists meet behind barriers, as anti-globalists scream and wail, and as a president finds himself ever more isolated, even by those who crafted him. And Russia turns its missiles towards Europe, as the U.S. plants its missiles along the Russian border. And China races headlong into a full-scale industrial mega-machine, while millions flee the land from drought, and pollution burns the eyes of even the dreamers. In just a moment, we launch our second month of weekly Earth Summits, and as you'll see, there's a new voice emerging, and it appears our time is coming, a time when a return to nature is a good thing. If only we can figure out how to beat the forces of chaos, over consumption, overpopulation, and of course, global climate change. Now in segment two, I love classical scientific research, and today we talk with two researchers who've spent the last 2 years trying to confirm the recent reports that that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, thought to be extinct for over 40 years, had recently been sighted. You remember the story, and then it kind of disappeared. Well, we're heading to Alabama to talk with Dr. Jeffrey Hill as he concludes his second year of intensive field study to prove that the ivory-billed woodpecker is, indeed, still with us. And then we head into the field, or shall we say swamp, as we talk with Brian Rolick, graduate student under Dr. Hill, who has lived in the middle of the Chuctahatchee Swamp in a tent for 10 full months. What's it like being a field biologist? You'll hear the full story, but first, we take you to the weekly Earth Summit that is about to convene right now. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. This is Sydney Wildsmith, and today we're going to hear from our regular guests, and as you'll hear, something is changing in the realms of nature and the environment. We'll compare notes as the summit ends, but now it's time we hear what's on the mind of our eight amazing guests. With so much challenging news these days about our future and the environment, it's always refreshing to hear about new discoveries. Dr. Robin Moore, Conservation International's leading amphibian action advocate, shares some exciting news from the field. Dr. Moore?
When it comes to reporting the findings of scientific research, Nothing grabs a public's attention quite like the discovery of new species. This week, we learned that 24 new species were found in the South American highlands of Suriname. These new findings included a black and fluorescent purple harlequin frog. The new species were uncovered by an expedition of 13 scientists led by Leanne Alonso of Conservation International, and the expedition took place only 80 miles from the capital of Suriname. The 24 new species included 6 species of fish, 12 dung beetles, a new species of ant, and 5 new amphibians. The researchers also found 27 species native to the Guyana Shield region, including the rare armored catfish, which has not been seen for 50 years. In all, the scientists reported 467 species at 2 sites, including monkeys, large cats, reptiles, amphibians, fish, bats, and insects. The areas in which the new species were discovered are, however, unprotected and may be threatened by small-scale illegal gold mining. The mining can pollute the water if not controlled properly, impacting amphibians, fish, as well as people. Stories of new discoveries such as this remind us that there are still parts of the world that remain unexplored by humans, and there's still much that we have to learn about our planet. It's easy to become jaded by doom and gloom stories about the environment. People generally don't like to hear about species going extinct. They do like to hear about new species being discovered. It is comforting to hear the occasional positive story. Anything that makes the public sit up and take an interest in species and the environment is, in my opinion, a good thing. The more people care, the more they will want to do to protect what we have.
Thanks, Dr. Moore. I'm sure you can feel the momentum and awareness finally building to appreciate, once again, animals and wonder. Dr. Mark Beckhoff, who serves the wild creatures as he advocates for the increased realization around the globe that animals must be treated as worthy and honored cohabitants. He shares some recent news.
There was an article called "I Am an Elephant" that appeared in a newspaper in Philadelphia that really, really decried the keeping of elephants in captivity and how they need to go to sanctuaries and not be kept in little prison-like cages in zoos. And what's really neat about that is the popular press is getting into the story about the way elephants and, of course, other animals suffer trauma. And what's really interesting is that 6 zoos in America have decided that they would be closing their elephant exhibits as the elephants passed away or got ill and had to be sent to a sanctuary, including the Bronx Zoo, the Detroit Zoo, the Philadelphia Zoo.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. What's really exciting these days is the way in which some solutions to our globalizing challenge have been around literally for millions of years. Dr. Lovejoy, please tell us what's on your mind this week.
A part of the solution suggested for a new energy scenario is to use biological resources as fuels. The Brazilians have been using sugarcane to produce alcohol for their automobile fleet for 30-odd years. And there's no question that these so-called biofuels will be an important part of the solution. But as usual, the devil is in the details, and it matters what you grow, where you grow it, and how you grow it. And I think one of the most intriguing possibilities is actually to use our native tall grass prairie, multi-species community of grasses, which are highly productive in the natural community, and at the end of their long growing season, they take all their critical nutrients back down into the root system, and all that's left above ground is cellulose, from which one can make cellulosic ethanol. So there you have a system which closely bases itself on a natural system, requires little input in terms of fertilizer or energy. So once again, we find important solutions in the natural world.
Dr. Thomas Lovejoy directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, and it's no wonder he sees such elegant examples that incorporate the three pillars of the center. Carl Pope directs the Sierra Club that has always been willing to push the wheels of change onto the right path. He shares, too, his observations that there are great things happening. Carl?
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the greenest of them all? Tulsa, Oklahoma,
the 500th American city to sign Kyoto? Utah, whose governor signed up for the fight on global warming, saying, "We are leading the charge. Washington has failed." New York City, where Mayor Mike Bloomberg took on the taxi drivers, cantankerous as they are, every taxi will be a hybrid within 5 years. Or Los Angeles, where Mayor Villaraigosa promptly raised Bloomberg, promising that the city of the angels, not the Big Apple, will be the greenest in the country. Or maybe it's J.P. Morgan, which told its investors, stay away from utilities that don't get efficiency. But it's not Washington. It still treats energy as the private playpen of the carbon monopolies. So much for coal, so much for oil, so much for gas and nuclear. Why don't you tell Congress it's time for action, not play acting?
Thank you, Carl. You're not the only one who sees a radical disconnect between the people's great wisdom and emerging sense of action and the administration as it continues to run off the road through our sacred lands. More and more people are taking action. Emma Sleeth, who is active in the Creation Care Movement, offers a unique play on the act in action.
There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for star differs from another star in glory. In fifth grade, I was in a class that put on a production of Macbeth. This was an annual thing. My brother had done it 2 years earlier. Only one problem. My class didn't have enough people, especially guys. There were maybe 9 kids in the class, but only 2 of them were male. Okay, when you think of Macbeth, who do you think of? Yes, the 3 witches and Lady Macbeth are female, but pretty much every other character is male. Obviously, we had to do double casting, and my teacher tried very hard to work with what she had, but it was challenging. Once we thought we had it all worked out, until the last scene, in which Douglas had to duel against, well, himself. But after much shuffling and recasting, we finally had it. Everyone had parts in which they didn't have to talk to themselves in a scene. Except Lady Macbeth, of course, but she's supposed to do that. And somehow, I was Macbeth. Now, I'm no actress, let alone actor, but I tried my best. I spent hours and hours on the bus memorizing, practicing saying Montulius, a word which I still have a hard time pronouncing, and silently envying Clark, who had been narrator 2 when his class had done it. I felt that I was cast wrong. The other girl named Emma in the class was the best actress. The only reason she wasn't Macbeth was that her identical twin sister was Lady, which might have been confusing for the audience. I should have stayed in the wings, where I belonged. I should have gotten the part of narrator 2, just like my brother. I might have had the dedication to the part of Macbeth and the literary love for his character, but I didn't have the acting skills or pronunciation, the knack for memorization, or the ability to convince an audience that a pipsqueak fifth-grade girl was really a murderous, raving king of Scotland that I was supposed to be. In the environmental movement, it is the same way. We often feel that God has cast us wrong, that we don't have the talents or skills for the job he has given us. We prefer to be a Macbeth in the wings. But that's not where we belong, not where he's told us to be. He's told us what our part is, whether narrator or lead, and we should be that part. That doesn't mean that he won't use the gifts that he's given us, that we're naturally good at, but it does mean it's a possibility. As is often said, God doesn't call the qualified, he qualifies the called. Star differs from star in glory. What has he called you to do? Has he asked you to be a leader? Has he asked you to narrate? Or has he asked you just to be in the audience as an active listener and educated citizen? Whatever he's asked you to do, do it. What if the sun had decided that it would really rather just be the moon? And what will happen to the ecosystem if a Macbeth of the environmental movement decides he'd really rather be in the wings?
Emma Sleeth has a book coming out that is directed to much of the faith-based community that is re-embracing its sacred responsibility to this earthly paradise. And speaking of books about the earth, Dave Foreman gives you this summer's reading list for your vacation, beach, and long summer evenings. Dave?
One of my real worries about the conservation movement today is that people aren't reading the classic conservation books. I find that a lot of young conservation activists who are very good at what they do haven't read the classic books, and this sometimes gets them into trouble because they don't know the lore and history of our movement. we need to do a lot more reading. On the other hand, I often get questions from people about what are the most important conservation books and what should they be reading to learn about different topics. Well, to answer that question, on the Rewilding Institute website, www.rewilding.org, I've launched a new feature called The Books of the Big Outside, in which I do short reviews of the most important conservation books in a variety of categories. Right now, there's 18 categories of conservation books I have there, and a total of 345 titles. Majority of those I do have short reviews, others I'm doing reviews for, but the Books of the Big Outside section is up and running. And so for those of you who might want to know what are the most important conservation books to read, what does it require a conservationist to be educated, to have some book learning, I would say the six most important books, and this I list in a six-pack of books from Uncle Dave, would be A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, Overshoot by William Catton, The Arrogance of Humanism by David Ehrenfeld, Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey, Wilderness in the American Mind by Roderick Nash, and The Diversity of Life by E.O. Wilson. Of recent books published in the last year or two, the six-pack would be Last Great Wilderness, Campaign to Establish the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge by Roger Kay, Predatory Bureaucracy, The Extermination of Wolves and the Transformation of the West by Michael Robinson, Let My People Go Surfing by Yvon Chouinard, The Winds of Change, Climate, Weather, and the Destruction of Civilizations by Eugene Linden, Rewilding North America, A Vision for Conservation in the 21st Century by yours truly, Dave Foreman, and Large Carnivores and the Conservation of Biodiversity, edited by Justina C. Ray. And if you want to learn about those books and many more, check out the Books of the Big Outside section on the Rewilding Institute website, rewilding.org. Thank you. Happy reading.
It's great to have an icon like Dave bring his years of dedication to saving the wild places to get us all more on the same page. Thanks, Dave. It's really quite hopeful, as Dr. Charles Kennel points out. Dr. Kennel?
Well, that's the hopeful side of it, isn't it? It's the one problem that everybody has. And even when the dialogue on other parts of our, international politics goes sour, we can still find a common interest in trying to solve this problem. And there is an analog in the past during the Cold War, which didn't involve everybody, but it was still the case that the scientists in particular managed to talk to each other on both sides of the Iron Curtain throughout the Cold War, and both sides realized they had a mutual interest in preventing a nuclear war, which thus far we have done. And so that was a huge achievement. And it was because there was a mutual interest that stretched across what looked like unbridgeable ideological and social chasms. And the same may be true now as we look at our fragmented global civilization and societies. But we all have this one interest, and we've got to find ways to work together on that. And that may build a bridgehead to a much closer and better relationship amongst all the societies of the world.
Thanks, Dr. Kettle. I wish I had the knowledge that you have from your years at NASA, Scripps, and the Pew Foundation. Few live with as broad a vision as our great friend, Dr. Charles Kettle. And sometimes, great wisdom is best expressed in a down-home fashion. And I'm finding that no one does that better than our final regular, here on the Weekly Earth Summit, Dr. Matthew Sleeth. Dr. Sleeth?
We try hard to keep our trash footprint light. We recycle everything possible. We use cloth shopping bags. And we practice pre-cycling, which is buying items with minimal packaging or in bulk or not at all. Recently, we've been doing some remodeling work on our home. Due to construction waste, we would have blown our trash footprint. We were saved from blowing our footprint by free cycling. Free cycling allows us to post the items we weren't going to use on a social network. Used baby cribs, exercise machines, bicycles, and cookware are cleaned out of one's closet and gotten by those needing the items. My wife Nancy posted our leftover lumber and even used wallboard on www.freecycle.org. Then people in our community came and removed the items. It's how we got our outdoor composting system last summer. There are 4,000 plus local free cycling communities nationwide and 3.5 million members. The one thing you can't do is sell your stuff. It's all free. You get to meet your neighbors, save money, and clean out your spare room or decorate it for free. Sometimes you get the chance to help neighbors that have lost everything in a flood, divorce, or other disaster. www.freecycle.org. One man's trash is another's treasure.
I've signed up with Free Cyclers here in San Diego, and I'm looking forward to spreading my lifelong collections of stuff, much of which is now in boxes and drawers and taking up room in my studio. Thanks, Matthew, for your wise and practical advice. So what did we learn from this weekly Earth Summit? I learned that we are making progress, that all these things we've been talking about and writing about and thinking about and worrying about for much of our lives is now reaching the threshold of action. Let's keep that big wheel rolling. This is Sidney Wildsmith thanking you for being part of the weekly Earth Summit. We've really just begun. In just a moment, we bring you up to the moment about the recent field work from the Choctahatchee Swamps, where the legendary and elusive ivory-billed woodpecker just may be hiding when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. And record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
For far too long, being smart wasn't cool. Being a scientist was, well, nerdy. But as we've been discussing on today's show, that's all changing. In just a moment, we head to the Choctahatchee River, where real-life field biologists have been camped for months trying to prove, once and for all, that the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker is, yes, alive. We talk with the lead researcher and then find out what it's like to be a real field biologist when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. You're tuned in. Following today's Nature News Update, we begin our journey into the realms of classic science as we talk with Dr. Jeffrey Hill, who has been leading a serious effort to capture scientifically irrefutable evidence that the ivory-billed woodpecker does indeed exist in Florida in the Choctahatchee River swamplands. And then you get the chance to see what it's like to be a real field biologist as we talk with Dr. Hill's dedicated graduate student, Brian Rolick, who's proved that real science is one of the greatest adventures of all. I'm sure you're going to enjoy today's guests. And so now, this week's Nature News Update. Global warming dominates the news from the G8 summit as much from the friction between President Bush and Vladimir Putin, and from Bush's newly found sense as a world leader facing the challenges of global warming. As yet, no breaking news to report. Hurricane Gonu raged up the Strait of Hormuz after hammering Oman with force 5 winds, which has shut down the flow of oil from that area for 2 days. The storm has since diminished to a force 1 storm as it heads into Iran. The effects of the storm may cause a short-term spike in gasoline prices around the world. Reports are that the uncertainties, wars, battles for space in a tightening world, and just plain greed are taking a significant toll on the world's historic sites. Surging development and commercialism and the ongoing political conflicts pose risks to sites as diverse as the Church of the Holy Nativity in Bethlehem, Peru's Machu Picchu, and hundreds of the world's most significant and ancient archaeological sites. Iraq's historic legacy has been shredded, and much has been looted. Whole pages of history have been torn from the book of life. More and more scientists, historians, and just plain people are beginning to promote peace amongst nations as a possible best option to preserve our human heritage on this ancient and mysterious earth. News from the global warming front keeps coming in faster and faster each day, mostly because it appears that global warming is accelerating faster than most experts had predicted. Residents of Greenland are particularly in the spotlight as the whole world watches the receding glaciers and the massive ice shelf cracking off in record time. Local residents who had only read about thunder now hear it regularly, only it is not from storms but from massive rifts in the ice fields that dominate the country. Many people are hoping that the Greenland ice sheet doesn't melt faster than expected because to do so could lead to a 23-foot rise in sea levels around the world. And there goes a lot of culture and history as coastal cities like New York and London would be effectively drowned. We'll keep you posted. And finally, the effects of something like global warming may be felt directly in the nation's second largest city. Residents of Los Angeles have been officially encouraged to bathe less, minimize sprinklers for lawns, and unnecessary washing of cars, as the city is potentially facing the most brutal water shortage in its history. The city may be forced to go on a full-out drought condition, as only 4 inches of rain has fallen since July of 2006, one quarter of the regular rainfall. This is the driest year in the last 130 years. The city's mayor, Villaraigosa, said the city needed to change course and conserve water to steer clear of this perfect storm. Others counter that the perfect storm would provide moderate rainfall for a week to remedy the effects of this otherwise looming regional crisis. And that's the news. We welcome the hundreds of new listeners streaming into the Wildside News, the Weekly Earth Summit, and becoming part of this emerging nature news network for action. Help us all by sending out invitations by email to your friends and adversaries alike to visit the Wildside News website at www.wildsidenews.com. That's www.wildsidenews.com. Once they come, they'll get the message. Thanks to all of my new listeners and, of course, to my many regulars. Now, let's get on with today's feature. We first talk with Dr. Jeffrey Hill, who has been leading the team on the quest to find the ivory-billed woodpecker. And then, we talk with Brian Rolick about what it's like to be a devoted field ornithologist on a great scientific quest. The world has been captivated in the last couple of years by the story of the potential sighting of what was thought to be a wild and extinct creature, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Now we're going to talk with the researcher who's been leading the quest to try to validate, again, the sightings of the ivory-billed woodpecker. And we've talked on the Wildside News here before with Dr. Jeffrey Hill. Dr. Hill, welcome to the Wildside News.
Oh, hi, Sydney. It's great to be back.
here we are, and it's June, and from what I understand, I've been following sort of the progress of this, hoping that there'd be a terrific announcement. It's now June, and I think you've kind of pulled your team from the Choctahatchee swamps and the river area. Tell us where things stand right now.
Yep. All of the searchers have gone home except one searcher who's responsible for setting remote cameras. He's still down in the swamp running the camera operation. But basically the whole search team has disbanded and gone home.
Well, I understand that one of the reasons for that is the fact that it just becomes almost totally inhospitable for humankind to be in that swamp at this time of the year.
Yeah, it's funny. Last year, May was actually very pleasant, I thought, relatively low mosquito numbers. And so this year we designed the search to go right till the end of May because temperatures usually aren't too bad in May. But this year, the mosquitoes were bad. It's such a environment in flux. And we had it's basically been a terrible drought year, but we had a high water event in April due to one big thunderstorm. The water came way up, flooded all the little back pools and everything, and then it got very dry and very hot, and I guess that was just ideal conditions for mosquitoes.
Yeah.
So into early May, we had tremendous mosquito population.
Well,
it was pretty miserable for these guys living, not just visiting, but actually living in the swamp. 24 hours a day, you're just beset by swarms. But they had a lot of good months. We had decent weather. The drought made lots of beautiful days down there. So weather is certainly not an excuse for why we didn't nail a clear image of this bird.
Well, you've been really, really aggressively doing some terrific field research based on great scientific technique. And is it that you just didn't get lucky?
Yeah, luck is a big part of this, but, you know, we're still trying to figure it out. Last year, with just our tiny little search crew, mostly just Brian and one other grad student, we had these birds consistently. We would have sightings very regularly, and we would hear the birds almost every day in the swamp. And you know, we figured that this was the site for ivory bills, this Choctahatchee. But it turns out that was probably... We were in an exceptional situation. We just happened to get right on a pair of birds. And in retrospect, I feel like we just blew a great opportunity last year. It's not like we didn't try hard, but the opportunities we had last year far exceeded what happened this year.
Why do you think that is?
It's hard to figure out. I think in my book at one point, I have a book that summarizes last year's search. I speculated based on this repeated sightings in one spot that there could be quite a few ivory bills in this river system. But now, with another year's experience, I think that was overly optimistic. I think there it's a very small number of birds in this big river system, this big swamp area. And so we're chasing very few birds in a very big area. And I think they respond to people. So it's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You go into to verify it, and it disappeared. So we may well have pushed these birds out of some of our search areas by searching for them.
I thought about that because you had 12 to 14 people in the field at any particular time.
It never felt like a very dense assembly of people. I mean, if you'd had a chance to get into the swamp, as a searcher, you go hours and even the full day and never run into another searcher. Mm-hmm. Of course, we spread out on purpose. And yet, we pretty much had somebody paddling or tromping through pretty much every piece of forest every few days.
Mm-hmm.
And that could have been a level of disturbance that really pushed the birds to other areas. I don't know. It's just pure speculation. All we know is that after a flurry of detections, right as we started in late December and early January, things got much more difficult. We continued with sound detections, but almost no good sightings after those early sightings.
Yeah, the bottom line is the fact that you were unfortunately not able to get that definitive photograph or video clip, which is the one that buys you a meal ticket for a while.
That's the one that would start a whole new era in ivoryville woodpecker conservation biology. We've left in this situation where, you know, we've got a pretty compelling body of evidence that these birds exist. But we don't have definitive proof that they exist. And by that I say we, I mean the whole community of bird watchers and ornithologists, wildlife biologists. I would say the majority of the professionals in this group are thinking this bird very well exists, but they're waiting for, you know, if it does exist, they would say
You should be able to document it. I agree with that.
No, that's how it's done.
For an animal, that should be impossible to document.
Yeah.
So it's very frustrating that we weren't able to do that.
Well, that's too bad. You know, it makes me wonder if, because this bird was believed to have been extinct for so long, in other words, people just plain didn't see the bird or didn't pay attention if they did, because they thought it didn't exist, it may be that this bird is just has been able to survive because it is so wary of humans.
Well, that's true. I mean, this bird has been persecuted for, and I don't think it's an exaggeration, probably more than 1,000 years. The Native Americans killed it in substantial numbers. They traded in its parts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then every group of human beings that's had anything to do with it has sought it out and killed it. And the birds that are left seem to be very, very wary of people.
It's kind of like the people who spend time looking for cougars and mountain lions. You rarely ever see one. I've spent literally years off and away and in wilderness areas, and I've seen the tail of a mountain lion.
Yeah,
that's all. Just the tail.
Yeah, that's right. And so mountain lions do get seen. I mean, within their range. But I think ivory bills of all the vertebrate animals in North America probably have the best strategy for escaping human notice. I mean, they live in dense forest with no exception. They're always in forest. They never, as far as we know, move out into the open. They live on the trunks of trees, so they've got a visual barrier, essentially, that they live on. And it's a real simple strategy for birds to, when they detect a person, move to the other side of the tree and fly away, and that makes them very hard to see.
Of course, the other side of that are like dodo birds that had no fear of humans and became extinct.
Left. Yeah, great hawks. Yeah, they used to herd great hawks onto ships like sheep because they were so trusting and helpless.
So these animals do adapt, you know, evolutionarily to the threats.
Yeah, well, we don't know whether it's an evolutionary response or just cultural response.
Right.
And these are animals with years or at least a year of nurturing by their parents. They get taught a lot of things. They're complex animals. And it may just be that it's a cultural transmission. They just get taught to be wary of people. I don't know that we necessarily have to invoke a genetic wariness, but it could be, could be a genetic wariness.
First of all, I commend you for your work. I'm a person who likes to take risks. I'm a person who likes to, because I'm a scientist, make predictions and come to analysis and announce it, because that's the best way to say, aha, I told you so.
Yeah.
But you're kind of in a bind right now. You're going to have to buy some time here.
I mean, it's a risk in a sense, but, I'm a professional ornithologist in the South.
Yep.
And what am I supposed to do but go try to document native animals? It's hardly like a crazy thing for an ornithologist to have gone to a local forested area and attempted to document a native animal.
It's happening all the time. And nevertheless, you're going to have to go and talk to people.
We're not shying away from this. We're just presenting what we got and trying to rationally analyze the things that we got. One explanation for the situation we're in is that it's all a big mistake. We misidentified these birds repeatedly, misidentified their sounds. It's always been something else, and it's, and we're wrong. But there's some elements to this that are very hard to explain away.
Well, share some of those, because that's what you're going to be talking about.
Sure.
And some of the people who are out in the field there, I know that any number of your people feel that they absolutely did have sightings of the ivory billed, but unfortunately they weren't able to capture it on the camera.
That's right, yeah. So this has been our problem. So we don't have proof, so we've already covered that. But the things we do have are really quite interesting. And one of the things that I think is most difficult to simply dismiss is that these ivory bill-like sounds and the things that look like ivory bills are linked in time and space. So there's a big crested woodpecker that's common in these forests, the pileated woodpecker, and that's a potential source for misidentifications, right?
Right.
We could reasonably misidentify a pileated woodpecker as an ivory bill woodpecker, even with great skill, just circumstances and what have you. It's a mistake. But pileated woodpeckers don't sound anything like an ivory bill. Now, they're banging on trees should typically not. Occasionally, a pileated will bang twice, and it could sound like a double knock, but pileated would never give a series of double knocks like an ivory bill would. So we hear these things. And then the sound of a pileated woodpecker is nothing like the sound of an ivory bill. the Pileas do this kind of maniacal laugh call, and Ivoryvilles do this weird, almost goose honking like Kent call. They're nothing alike.
Very diminutive.
That's right. Really unimpressive for such a visually impressive bird.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing that we would mistake, the sounds that we would mistake for Ivoryvilles have one source, and the visual stimuli that we'd mistake for Ivoryvilles have another source. So they should be totally independent. We should be tricked into thinking we hear an Ivoryville should occur separately from being tricked into thinking we're seeing an Ivoryville.
Yep.
But instead, these things happen together. When I had my best sighting, personally, when I was watching an Ivoryville fly away from me, clear view, and I was quite certain of what I was seeing, after I had identified the bird positively as an Ivoryville, I clearly heard a double knock to my right, which I also identified as Ivoryville. There's nothing else that I know that makes a double knock. Now, in order for us to say that was something other than an Ivoryville, we have to have the one time in my life that I misidentified a fleeing pileat as a Ivoryville is being linked to this very rare sound mistake, a double knock occurring. And it seems very unlikely that you get these two things occurring independently.
What was the kind of relative frequency? I mean, what was your how often did those things occur together? That's a hard statistic to hammer out.
Right. I think, we should go through our data and actually calculate that, but quite often. In the sound recordings, it was about a 90 or 100-day recording period in 2006, we had 11 days in which both Kent calls and double knocks occurred together, the same mm-hmm. location at the same time.
Mm-hmm. How about frequency of sighting in that case?
And that was right on top of where our sightings were.
Mm-hmm.
That's another interesting thing. That site where we had such a flurry of detections and activity in 2006 went completely dead in 2007.
Mm.
We set up recorders again, and I had to check this statement with Dan, but as of last report, we had no Kents or double knocks detected in those same places where we had so many in 2006. And our search team had nothing. Matter of fact, it was so demoralizing for that search team, worked in two groups, that we moved them because they were, imagine looking for one thing for months and months and getting no sound detections, no sightings. So we moved them up towards this other area where we had activity, and they started to hear and see things. The point there is that the automated sound detections followed the sightings and in-life sound detections.
It generates a lot of speculation about what may be going on and raises a lot of questions. The fact that areas that at one time were active and then became inactive would actually suggest that there was a population, maybe one or two, that were moving around.
It makes you think that there's individual birds in the swamp forest and they move, and that makes the sightings and the sound detects move in the swamp.
Based on the study now that you've been doing for a couple of years here, what are you thinking about the birds in this area? I'm sure you're fairly well convinced that they're there, but what are you learning about how you're envisioning their lifestyle?
What we're learning is kind of having beat into us is there's not many of these birds, and so it's a complete mystery how they've survived to this point, and we are completely ignorant of what we're seeing. We don't know if we've discovered Ivoryvilles as they've come back from the brink of extinction are becoming more abundant, or we discovered them just as they're petering out, it's the last few birds and they're going to be extinct in a few years, or this is a stable state they've been in for 100 years. There's no way to know.
Yeah.
All we know is we've caught glimpses and recorded the sounds of a few birds.
Yeah. Obviously, if it was a breeding couple, then there would be the chance, at least, or the hope, that they would have to set up establish a nesting area,
yeah.
and that would have helped you out.
That's what we were after this year,
yeah.
Obviously, finding a pair at a nest.
Yeah. At this point, what's your summary of your research to this point?
Well, unfortunately, it's pretty much a recap of what we had last year. We got more of the same. We got lots of sound recordings. We had some sightings. Some pretty good sightings. So one that was excellent, hard to dismiss. Big holes in trees, seem bigger than should be made by pileated woodpeckers, and bark scaling, but nothing definitive.
Mm-hmm.
We've even got poor quality video and pictures. Nothing that you can really hold up and say this absolutely is an Ivoryville woodpecker.
So where do you go from here?
We have to think about it this winter. I can't lead another search of this magnitude. It's just too draining. I don't have the resources. I don't have a staff to rely on. It's just pretty much me and my grad students. We will encourage anybody that wants to pick up the Chokhtachi search to do so. I think there's enough interest among enough bird watchers that people will get in here and keep kicking around. And we've really tried to get the word out to the local people in the Florida Panhandle that they should get this picture. Fishermen or hunters should do this. The local woodsmen probably have a better chance to get a picture of this bird than anybody. And we just had to convince them that it's a good thing to do.
Well, if there's a population out there, as you say, through time, with the education that you've been able to generate from your study and all the press and media that you've had, if the birds are out there, someone's going to see them eventually.
Absolutely. And get a picture of them eventually.
Yeah.
We've had so many local people recount tales of Ivoryville, and very convincing. You know, details, they describe the sounds, they describe the sights.
How recently?
The stories go all the way back to a story of a guy that shot one when he was a teenager in the 40s,
uh-huh.
Buried it in his backyard. A really convincing story,
uh-huh.
Up through current. That guy told us he knew where they nested 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, and some of these are going to be mistakes, but there's so much detail in some of these stories, and there's so much lore of this bird in the area, it's hard to believe that there isn't a kernel of truth in some of these stories. And so I think it's not unlikely that a local person could find some evidence. Pile of feathers, get a picture of a bird, locate a nest and get us to it, and we can go up and find eggshells in the nest or something like that.
Well, if my life was different, I'd be out there in that swamp in the better days.
Take a few days and get down there. It really is a fun place to paddle around in a boat.
That'd be great. Well, maybe I'll get in touch with you when you're heading out there sometime. It'd be fun to go out there with you.
Yeah.
Be exciting.
Yeah.
Well, if for people who want to continue learning more about this story, let's give them the best way to do so.
We have a website. It mostly talks about the 2006 search, but it's got an update link. That's www.auburn.edu/Ivoryville. That links to Dan Mennell's page. He's my faculty colleague who's done all the sound work in this project, and he's got all the Ivoryville sounds from 2006 posted on his website.
Yeah, one thing you've done is you've been very generous about sharing the information.
We're trying to be very open about everything we're doing so everybody can assess the evidence and decide for themselves. We don't see any advantage to secrecy. To this point, we've been withholding some of the exact locations where we're working, but we're kicking around the idea of doing complete disclosure, GPS coordinates of every sighting to this point, because at this point, there's not many people that are willing to get into the swamp anymore. That's sort of the initial excitement's gone for a lot of people, and we need a few searchers down there.
Yeah, I guess I'd wonder about that if that's a good idea. That's just my thought because there's enough goofy people out there that might take advantage of that. But
well, the swamp protects itself in a lot of ways. It's big and difficult to work in, and it's not going to be easy for one person to go in and just spoil the area or something.
Well, the swamps are known for creepy, crawly things. So
there's already a lot of characters down there, so they can blend right in with the local culture that already exists in the swamp down there.
Well, listen, it's always good to talk with Dr. Jeffrey Hill, who's we're talking with right now. He's with Auburn University in Alabama. Good luck. We'll keep in touch, and I hope one of these days you'll be able to make that announcement that your work has paid off.
We're still setting remote cameras, even though things have wound down a lot. It's not impossible. One of these days, my picture guy, Jamie, could call me up and say, we got it.
You know, and I'm sorry, I should have asked this before, but that's the one thing that I had the greatest hope. You set up a whole series of these time-lapse cameras on all sorts of different cavities, and somehow it just didn't work, did it?
Not to this point. We haven't gotten that picture. I'm afraid that the cameras we used necessitated being set too close to the cavity.
Oh, it could be too.
If these birds are as crazy wary as we're starting to realize they are, it's possible we need to go to a different camera design that we set back farther from the cavities. They certainly might notice a big clunky camera within 100 feet of their nest, or especially we're setting them close to the feeding trees, maybe within 30 feet.
Yeah.
And some people in my research group don't think that's possible. But I talk to other people that say, even birds that are less wary generally will shy away from a camera set. Just it's got an eye-looking part to it, and it just scares them. So That's one thing we might do, is go to a better surveillance camera.
Okay, well, Dr. Jeffrey Hill, always good talking with you, and you be sure to call me if and when you get that definitive.
Oh, we will. Maybe not the very first person, but you'll be on the list of people we call.
I'd look forward to it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Uh-huh, bye.
Bye. Real science is often an adventure, and when it comes to field work, it requires a level of dedication and a willingness to serve the discovery that not just anyone can embrace, but for those who do, it's a life-changing experience. Well, following our discussion with Dr. Hill, now it's time to take a look at the people who do some of that really hard work, and that's called field work. And joining us now from Auburn, Alabama, is Brian Rolick, who spent literally months and months and months looking for the bird. Brian, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Hello, it's good to be here today.
Well, you just got back from your latest journey into the Choctahatchee, and we'll talk about that. But I'd like to go back to how this all began. And apparently you have been working with Dr. Hill as a graduate student, and you were involved in one of the first sightings. As a matter of fact, perhaps you're responsible for that first sighting following the original sighting that happened in May of the ivory-billed woodpecker. Tell us how that came about.
Jeff and I and Tyler Hicks were paddling down the Choctahatchee. We were actually inspired by the Arkansas find. You know, we thought we'd just go look for some habitat and do some breeding bird surveys points while we're out there. And so we were just paddling down the river, and I saw what I thought was an ivory-billed woodpecker. And I just felt a responsibility to report it, and we wanted to follow up and document the bird.
You were the first person to kind of note this. You made that first sighting. At that time, what was it that really caught your eye that made you feel as if this was an ivory-billed?
I'd been bird watching for several years, at least 4 years by then, and I know my eastern birds very well, southeastern and northeastern,
mm-hmm.
and especially woodpeckers. I saw this bird fly off the tree, and it clearly had white secondaries. It was a large bird. It swooped off of the trunk as a woodpecker would, and it was just, to me, seeing it was unmistakable, so that's what convinced myself.
Obviously, you're familiar with the pileated woodpecker, and you've undoubtedly seen probably many of those. What were the characteristics that were different from pileated?
I didn't see a red crest on this bird, and I thought the crest was actually black, which would mean a female ivory-billed woodpecker, or possibly a male, because they have black on the front of their crest, which may fold down when they extend their neck to
mm-hmm.
fly. So the absence of that red, I thought, was actually pretty significant, because I've seen thousands of pileated woodpeckers, and I can spot that red crest from pretty far away, over 100 yards probably. And so that and the white trailing edge was very obvious to me. Any bird watchers who are familiar with red-headed woodpeckers know what I'm talking about. Those white secondaries can really stand out. They're very bold and flashy, and those were really the two things that convinced me. I didn't have it in my binoculars, so I didn't get much more detail than that. And the size was where the bird should be around.
Mm-hmm. And how close were you to that bird?
I don't really remember exactly. I think it was 50 meters.
Then you did share this with Dr. Hill, and what was his response?
He just sort of had a shocked look on his face. I mean, it was really a naive observer. I was a naive observer at that point. I just described to him what I saw. He didn't say anything to me at first, and after paddling up a little bit, I was like, there's nothing else it could have been, because I didn't really envision what the bird would have looked like in flight beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew what it looked like perched on a tree. And after realizing what the plumage characteristics would look like in flight, I think that they decided before I did that I'd probably seen it. But I stopped and I said, I think that was it, guys.
Mm, really? At that point, a decision had to be made to go back and take a second look and try to validate your sighting. What was involved in that?
We had followed a little bit of what Cornell was doing, and we decided we needed an audio person, somebody that could basically make more manpower out in the swamp than we actually had. So we contacted Dan Mennell, who had worked with our lab before, and he became our audio man, and he designed these listening stations that you can put out in the woods, and they just record 24 hours a day, and he has people back in the lab scanning them and filtering sounds out of them, getting double knocks and cants. that way we could focus in on what area the bird was actually in.
Exactly. That was an ongoing process. But you're the guy who went out into the field, and that's what I really like to explore, because you had the great adventure of becoming a really, truly dedicated field biologist. Talk about how you made that commitment and how that came about.
We had agreed at first not to tell anyone except for people directly involved with the project, just because we thought it would be neat to do this as our own project. We thought it would be easy with a small crew. So we had me and Kyle Swiston from Dan Mendel's lab out there, and basically it was me and him camping the whole time with visitors occasionally on the weekends. Some people stayed for much longer than that. Some people volunteered for about 2 weeks here and there.
Mm-hmm. But a long time. This began in the fall, actually December of 2004, and how long were you out there in the first take?
The first season I was out there until the end of April. That seemed to be a good time to leave. There were lots of mosquitoes. It was getting hot out at that point.
Now, what were living conditions like for you? How did you manage to get by?
It actually varied a lot. So we had to boat. We just had a canoe that year. It was about an hour paddle to bring our groceries and water in. We did have a generator going because we had a lot of batteries and electronics to charge. It varied a lot. I mean, from the winter time, we had freezing mornings where you get out there and you just defrost the frost off your kayak by sitting on it. and also in the winter, is completely flooded swamp. Very different than when you went out in the summertime. And it's if you went out to the Takahashi now, it looks like the river's almost dried up. So we went from being able to kayak through the forest in the winter time to now you'd be hiking everywhere and balancing over logs to get across creeks and things.
Tell us a little bit about the actual physical setup of your camp. Talk a little bit about the tent, and did you have pads for your sleigh? I mean, just curious about how how a person spends 4 months out in the woods on an adventure like this.
We had a central tarp area where Kyle and I would cook dinner. We always cooked for each other. Usually something very simple, pasta or rice and beans, because me and Kyle aren't very good cooks. And then we had two tents for ourselves. I had one, and Kyle had one, and we kind of stayed away from each other to give each other a little space. And a little next to the community tent was a campfire area where me and Kyle spent many nights just talking and eating our dinner. And, of course, those who came down, like Jeff, when he came down every other weekend, we spent a lot of time with him there, too.
So give us a sense of what a typical day would be like.
So a typical day would be I would get up pre-dawn, and I would try to I usually would have a cavity that I was interested in monitoring. So I would hike as fast as I could with a GPS unit to try to make it to that cavity before dawn and set up so that I was far away from it. And I would keep an eye on that, basically watch that cavity to see if anything came out of it. After that, I usually spent a lot of time hiking around the swamp, looking for new areas, looking for new cavities, what we considered might be foraging sign, and GPSing it. In the afternoon, I would set up video cameras on several cavities and let them run until dusk, mm-hmm. and then I'd come pick them up at some point the next day.
So you were busy most of the day?
Usually dawn till dusk. Then I'd go back in my tent, and I would we didn't have a television or anything, so I would watch these videos of birds if they came in and out of the cavity. Just videos of the cavity in fast forward on the little LCD screen of the camera itself.
Fascinating. That is really a full day.
It wasn't very entertaining either.
When you went into this, did you have some sense of how long you might be out there? Because basically you just wanted to document, get a good shot or either video or still shot of the bird. How long did you kind of imagine it might take to accomplish that?
I anticipated having a full field season out there. Even if I documented it, there's always the next step. You know, you want to document it. You want to observe its behavior. You want to see if it's breeding and see what its daily range is, what it's foraging on. So there's always more questions, especially on a bird that's very understudied like this one.
But unfortunately, in that first season, you weren't able to accomplish getting a definitive shot. What were some of the thoughts that would occur to you as a field biologist out there after, let's say, a couple of months? What began to sort of move into your head in terms of thoughts about where you were, what you were doing?
Honestly, last year I was much more involved with the actual search itself, and I had many in-life detections that were extremely convincing to me. Just there was nothing else that could have been double knocking up in a tree in front of me, for example. You would go through periods where you would hear nothing for about a week, and it obviously, you know, you could, it's rough. You get down, you say, oh, this thing probably doesn't even exist, and you get pessimistic about it. And you're dealing with an animal that has always been known to cover huge areas, so your chances of running into it aren't very high, especially when it's one individual. So a lot of times I just say, oh, I'll just keep documenting cavities and we'll measure these for data later. And I would have almost given up, and then all of a sudden you'll hear this line of double knocks that are moving towards you, getting closer or something, and you just think, wow, that was amazing. There's nothing else it could be. And that even I had a sighting or two when at times like that when I was extremely down. There were points where I had almost given up, and I mean, and I said, this bird probably doesn't exist. You know, maybe it was all fluke. Then there I would see it again a little bit later or hear something like that.
During that first season, the audio recordings were sent back to the labs actually afterwards and analyzed, but you yourself had your own, you know, relationship to that reality. Did you feel that you had actually had in your own mind or in your own experience an actual sighting?
Oh, yes, several of them. There were a few times where, I mean, I was just absolutely certain of what I saw. And usually I wrote down notes right after that and described every field mark I could describe. And so at the end of the season, we had actually pulled out, and we went to another area to explore of Wide Swamp. And Jeff decided, we haven't had a video yet. We're keeping a video camera rolling at all times. So he mounted a video camera on his kayak. And I had a sighting at that point. And so this is 1 out of 10 sightings. We haven't reviewed many tapes or anything total from the search. And this tape has a bird that's interesting looking on it, and it's consistent with the field mark of an ivory-billed woodpecker, but it's not definitive. It's in no way definitive at all. It is pixelated and blurry. But what are the chances of that happening? You know, and what are the chances of hearing Kent-like and double knock sounds at the same time, which are attributed to blue jays and knocking trees, like whatever you want to attribute it to, what's the chances of those sounds happening at the same time like that? I think what we compiled was very suggestive evidence, but not the definitive proof that people expect for this bird.
Well, they also have a unique behaviors in terms of the peeling of the bark, their holes that they bore into the trees. So did you notice any of that actually developing while you were out there? Did you notice that there was bark being peeled or that there were new holes being bored into trees by what you might assume could be an ivory bill?
Certainly, yeah. All of that was going on. I would find foraging sign occasionally, and sometimes it would be in a new spot I haven't covered. Sometimes it would be a spot I covered all the time, and then all of a sudden it appeared there, you know. I knew that something had made that recently, and that was very interesting to me. Sometimes I would put cameras on them, too. I would mount a camera to a tree, a video camera, and just it had a four-hour tape and just let it run.
Now, and we'll kind of fast forward ahead here, too, because based on that first season out there in the field between December and April, a lot of decisions were made about how to return to the field then again in the next winter. What were some of the major decisions and, for example, changes in gear and style of research that you undertook?
Extremely different, a very different atmosphere. I mean, we had 12 technicians and plus volunteers, and rather than being able to search the whole time, I was mainly in charge of keeping these people running. It didn't have the quiet outside nature sort of thing. It was a little more, everybody was just very determined to get this bird, a lot of bird watchers who were really excited about it. I wasn't used to dealing with that amount of people in the swamp, because normally I walked around all day and didn't see anybody, or maybe saw a hunter, you know. It was just a very different atmosphere.
Well, that's unfortunately one of the downsides of success.
Well, yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about that second year then. You were managing a lot of the field work. There were men and women out there, 12 people, you said. What was the approach this time?
Well, our goal was to run transects through the forest to document every scaling and the most importantly, large woodpecker cavities that we could find. We wanted to monitor these cavities and scalings with time-lapse cameras. So that's exactly what we did. We had a field site where we had the video and my sighting, and we ran these straight line transects through the forest, GPSed every single cavity so that it could be refound by the time-lapse coordinator, who was Jamie Hill. And so he would go back and put these cameras up as soon as he could afterwards. And we graded them so that, larger ones had a higher priority.
And these took a picture about how often?
They're actually completely adjustable. You can take a picture from, I think, something like 0.2 seconds to 30 seconds. So we usually did about, I think, 4 seconds on a cavity.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very frequent.
Sometimes a woodpecker in the afternoon will just fly straight into its cavity, and you could easily miss it with a second. So we actually had shortened deployments, and we're trying to tighten that up, that time frame up, so that it was unlikely that you miss it. But then you have a shot again in the morning, mm-hmm. to get it coming out.
Now, just curious, too, did you have a base camp where most of these people gathered, or were they spread out throughout the forest?
Yeah, we had two base camps set up. We did move camp several times because of not having success getting a picture. We tried to adapt a bit to where people had thought they heard the bird and things like that, and where we thought was promising.
We're going to kind of fast forward again, and this time you spent 6 months out there. As a matter of fact, you've just returned. You're 5 days out of the field.
That's right.
How are you adjusting?
I'm doing fine. I'm happy to be out, and I'm glad I left in April the year before, because the mosquitoes and the heat get really bad after that.
Yeah, and that gets to be old after a short period of time.
Yeah, well, when you're out there working all day and you're in the mosquitoes and in the heat, and then you get home and you're still in the mosquitoes and in the heat, back at base camp, it's not a good time.
Well, long and the short of it, in terms of this most recent field work, how was your success?
We didn't get the video or the picture, so in that way, you could say that we failed our mission. We're still going to keep looking, and we're hoping that maybe we were just in the wrong area. There are areas that are uncovered in this river system that we plan on going back to. I plan on doing my entire master's work in this area, trying to learn more about the river system.
With that many people in the field, were there ever times when there were concurrent calls or knocks in different places that might indicate more than one bird?
Well, actually, the best one, I would call it the best one because I was there. Me and Tyler Hicks were together, and we heard two double knocks clearly going back and forth to each other, and one was very close. There's nothing else it could have been besides a woodpecker in a tree. There weren't any people in the area. There weren't any hunters. No one was shooting up in a tree or anything. So we recorded the second set of these double knocks on our video camera. Actually, Tyler captured the entire thing. What we have is a series of 9 double knocks, 2, then 5, then 2. So there's nothing more convincing than when you're there in person and you videotape something like that. And we thought, wonderful, we have two birds. This means that they are breeding in this river system. Unfortunately, the only thing after that, which actually won another great one, was that Tyler and Greg Lubart and Diane Darasinski were following double knocks and Kent calls. They were on the radio to each other saying, hey, I heard this, head south. And they could see each other's position on the radios that we have. So they followed it south, and it actually ended in a sighting for Tyler Hicks. And that, to me, is one of the most convincing things I've ever heard. The three observers hearing these double knocks and then ending in a sighting.
There must be a level of frustration in the fact that with all of this effort, you still haven't been able to get that camera on that bird.
Of course. I agree completely. You can just imagine being out there for living in the swamp for 2 years and just no success with a picture. It's very frustrating, and I can find other projects in the woods, and maybe I'll just be there someday and the bird will land in front of me.
So I have to believe you mentioned that you'd been back to Boston to spend some time with friends. So they roll their eyes around once in a while just to let you know that they think perhaps you're just a little bit off base?
Oh, they think I'm crazy just for staying in the swamp.
There you go.
That's I tell them about the poisonous snakes and the gators down there, and they say, oh my gosh, you're crazy, I'm afraid of garter snakes. I'm like, okay, well, that's the way you are, is the way I am. I have a good time out there. So.
How old are you, by the way?
I'm 26 years old.
26? You've really tattooed your life with this experience. This is something that will live with you the rest of your life. Do you look forward to more experiences like this, or do you think you've gotten this out of your system and you're going to head off for some sort of simpler form of field research?
Well, right now, there's no way I could camp out in the swamp for several months again. I think I'll probably be wanting to go back in there pretty soon, at least for a couple weeks here and there.
You spent a lot of time literally in the woods in the swamp. What do you take away from that experience, that deep immersion into the wild, like a swamp wilderness?
Just that what we have here in the southeastern United States is actually an amazing ecosystem. A lot of people really don't respect it. To me, it almost seems like our own rainforest. The diversity is incredible. Every day we found new animals and unexpected things, birds that weren't supposed to be there, like limpkins. You still have fun no matter what you do because you're exploring really unexplored territory. I mean, it's a unique place.
Oftentimes when you spend time in a place, some animals will become acclimated to you. That's just natural. It's kind of interesting and fun. Any animals that became acclimated to your camp?
Well, we had a possum who liked to get in and out of our trash until we boxed it up. But besides that, we had a Carolina wren who decided to nest in my boot also. So luckily my boots were leaky at that time, so I just left it there for them.
In terms of your research going forward now, what do you hope to do?
I hope to quantify the vegetation in the Chokahatchee and learn more about woodpeckers in general, and who knows, maybe while I'm doing that, I'll still get the picture.
We're talking with Brian Rolick, who spent 10 months of actual field work looking for the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker. He's got the bug now. It's bit, and he's not going to let go of this one. Terrific work, Brian, and it's been great talking with you, and we'll keep informed, particularly as some of the research is analyzed and also into the future here.
Yeah, thank you. It was wonderful talking with you as well.
Thanks for coming along on today's show. The times, they are a-changing, and it's what many of us have worked long and hard to achieve. Keep up the good work, and someday we may even get there. Where? Back to the garden. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks truth to wonder, here on the Wild Side News.